all this time, Porter. Everything you've done, everything you've said, I've heard all about. So you've made some remarks in the past about when is Papa Fritz going to be here. Papa Fritz is here.
Championship Wrestling on the network. I'm Pete, and I'm joined by Kelly and Johnny. Kelly, how you doing?
Doing good, brother.
That's awesome, man. Johnny, what's going on this Labor Day?
Just hanging out, just waiting to record a podcast.
There we go. You know, I've been looking at the WWE Network now, and I'm actually kind of beginning to really like the new interface where you can type in a guy wrestler's name or even put, like, say, Tito Santana in 1987, and a ton of stuff will pop up for him. My big complaint, though, is if you watch one match and you want to arrow back on the Roku, it disappears, so you got to restart all over again by typing the guy's name in. That's been my biggest drawback on the new looking for stuff on the network, but I'm really digging now the new interface and how it's set up. I'm getting more familiar with it. What about you guys? Are you guys getting more familiar with it?
Yeah, I've liked it from the beginning. I think it's better, definitely better.
Yeah, I'm getting used to it.
Yeah, I think for me at first I was like, but I think it's more about change, getting more used to it. I think the network is actually pretty awesome when it comes to being able to watch a lot of stuff that you really enjoy on there. Especially ever since they put on the Hidden Gems things. So for me, that's been a major plus. Yeah. But when you guys heard they were going to do an Adrian Street documentary on the thing, he would be one of the guys I would never in a million years think they would do. He'd be a guy I thought they would never mention on the network. Or bring up. I mean, I know he'd be in the network, but I never thought they would actually do a documentary on him. Where do you feel about that, Kelly? Do you think, were you really surprised when they did that?
Yeah, kind of. But then when you think about that they're doing now the NXT UK thing, and that it debuted right after the UK takeover, then it makes sense that it was something that they planned, and maybe in the future they'll highlight some other English guys, British guys from the past.
And he's alive, unlike Billy Robinson or the British Bulldogs. Both of them are dead who meant more in the WWE, per se, because I don't think Adrian Street had a cup of coffee in the WWE, you know?
I don't think a single match, as far as I know.
Yeah.
No.
And now, John, I know you saw the doc. So did I. I absolutely loved it. What about you?
Oh, I thought it was great. You know, I wish it could have been longer. It was a half hour long, but for a half hour long show,
yeah,
it was really, really good. And
I think you're being kind by calling it 30 minutes. I think it went 20.
Something like that. But yeah. Here's the thing, though. He never wrestled there, but I've seen tons of pictures on his social media and stuff of him backstage, him with Vince, him with various people. So he's well-liked. Apparently, he's known and well-liked by everybody. He just never worked there. So, and that's the thing with the network now. It's like with their Hall of Fame. They're like, well, yeah. Abdul is in it, and he never even wrestled there. Mm-hmm. It's like, it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. They got all the footage. So they've got all this footage. They're going to do something about Adrian Street? Great. I mean, it's so funny because you think back to the days where, well, he never worked there. Vince would never allow anything like this. And those days are gone.
Yeah.
They're completely gone.
Yeah, and you know, in the end, he won the war, and he owns all the footage, so he might as well monopolize on it and do something that's kind of cool. And you know, I can guarantee it meant a lot to Adrian Street. They did something like that for him.
Yeah, big time, and it's neat. I mean, they even include some Memphis footage in the doc. you know, of him and Savage.
Yep.
And without giving anything away for anybody, he briefly mentions that they decided to put him in there with Savage because they felt he was the guy who could handle him in case he got a little out of control.
Yeah, he's fat a shooter. Thing. I thought Regal was a major star of this documentary. His reaction to of Adrian kissing Terry Taylor on the finish was absolutely, it was just great. And it's a match that's on the network. They show the finish on the documentary. I recommend you go out and see it. It's like 8 minutes long. Super fun match. Now, the finish happened at the Irish McNeil Boys Club. I'll ask you, Kelly, first. And that's in a more safer environment. It's obviously a boys club. It's not Mid-South's regular stomping ground. Do you think they would play that finish regularly in like some of the more podunk places that Cornette would talk about? I've always forget about that one. Oma, I think, is one of the ones he always talks about. Do you think they would have played that finish at an arena?
I don't know. I mean, Street was in a lot of the Southern territories, right? And I don't think there was any like riots or anything that got out of control or anything.
But, I mean, we never saw Adrian Street kiss somebody.
Right, yeah.
You didn't see the docs. Okay, let me explain the finish to you. And, you know, it's Taylor's defending the TV title. The finish is Street kisses him, and it stuns him, and he pins him 1-2-3.
Well, I think that's a brilliant finish, and
yeah,
hopefully the sophisticated fans in the Irish McNeil Boys Club thought so as well.
Well, I think there's a lot more younger fans there, so I think it's a lot more safer environment than taking it out where. Think about it. In 1984, in some of these territories in the Deep South in Louisiana. I mean, the people weren't liberal back then. Let's just put it that way.
Well, here's the thing. I'm willing to bet he did that in other places, in other arenas and other areas too, because, A, getting out of the ring, and they touched on this on the doc. Number one, he could handle himself. Yeah. Number two, Miss Linda could handle herself. Like, yeah. One of her jobs was when the fans went after him, as they put it in the documentary, she'd lay a kicking on him. You know, so, you know, if somebody came at him, some podunk hillbilly came at him because he did the kissing spot, he would have gotten that Miss Linda's spiked forearm right in the face. So
yeah.
I'm pretty sure, I bet you he did.
Yeah, I don't want to say I've watched a ton of Street, but I've watched a lot of Street. And I just never seen that finish before. And I think it's a brilliant finish. And they don't, you think Bill Watts would be going really over the top on watching it. Yeah, people should check it out. It's I thought they handled it pretty well, to tell you the truth. You know, and those are the type of characters. I also liked how they, you know, through obviously Goldust was inspired by Adrian Street. They showed Velveteen Dream or two guys. I don't think they showed Rico, did they?
No, they showed they showed like DiBiase and Beefcake and like all the colorful characters of the late 80s. But then they did show, you know, side by side him with the Velveteen Dream and Gold Dust and gosh, who else? Shawn Michaels and various other characters, just, you know, showing how much influence he had on all.
I guess, you know, showing Rico, which is a character that never got over, I guess.
Yeah, were they going to show Rico and everyone's going to go, who?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But people, if you guys have not checked out that doc, it's definitely worth the 20 minutes. It feels like it's something that should have gone at least an hour. But that's, I mean, you can't complain about something. You know, this is what they aimed it at, and this is what it's for. But clearly, there's they touched a little bit about on his background of growing up in the coal miners' guild, type of like that's kind of what his town was known for. And you know, there's a lot more that went into that, and I'd be just fascinating to watch it. But yeah, that was just really, really interesting and stuff. But hey, let's move on to 9/17/1983 on World Class Championship Wrestling. And, you know, we opened up with Jimmy Garvin with Chris Adams, which is a replay of what we watched, 2 weeks ago, I believe?
Mm-hmm. Just last week, I think.
Was it last week?
Yeah.
Okay.
It said recorded 8/26/83. So I believe that was aired. But I don't want to. Let's not rehash the match. But I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about the feud, because this is kind of like the match that starts it. But I'll ask you first, Kelly. Do you find it pretty fascinating here? Because Garvin and Adams ends up becoming a really strong feud in world class. And we've been watching now since 82. But this will be the first feud that doesn't feature a Von Erich or a Freebird. They get super over. Am I correct? I mean, we've had some other ones, like maybe Brody and Kamala, but they don't really follow much up on it. And we know Brody got over before in previous times. But this is really the first feud since they started pushing the Three Brothers and the Freebirds. And of course, all the 82 we watched. This is really the first standalone feud that doesn't involve the Freebirds or the Von Erichs, huh?
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. 82, I can't think of anything. That was
I was just trying to think, and I'm like going, me versus Jay Saldi? I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh, come on. How could we forget David Manning versus Frank Dusick? Come on. Yeah. That was a big one.
That was hot. That was sellouts from all over Texas. Yeah. Yeah. And according to Mercer, it's a feud between gentleman Chris Adams and gentleman Jimmy Garvin.
Oh, yeah.
At the beginning.
Oh, here's how he starts. He goes, remember when Jim Garvin won the America's title? What a way to start. You know, and he goes, so up next, it's exactly what he says. Gentleman Chris Adams versus gentleman Jim Garvin. And then he chuckles and smiles.
Yeah, because he knew he fucked the line up.
Yeah.
But no, we're not going to retake that. Jesus. But you even look at the camera like, whoops.
Whoopsie, with a big dumb grin. And he does get off this line, though, afterwards when they come back. He says, it's summertime, sunshine, and gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. I was like, oh, that was pretty good.
Why do you think this – I'll ask you, Johnny. Why do you think this clicked as opposed to some of the other things they've tried?
Well, I don't know what else they've tried, to be perfectly honest with you, with the exception of anything involving the world title, the Von Erichs,
right.
Gary Hart, Von Erichs, Freebirds, Von Erichs. I think it worked because I think people were getting tired of it constantly being those characters. And with Adams and Jimmy Garvin, you had two characters who the audience really took to. You know, they were strong. And so it just makes sense to go, well, we got to have something else going on besides, you know, something with the boys. And I think that's why – and the audience has fallen – I mean, they've done a really great job of introducing Chris Adams, you know, and building Chris
Adams. Kind of slow, yeah.
Yeah, a nice slow job. But they've really built him up credibly. And Garvin, of course, was immediately over because of the character. And I think –
And he got a feud with David right off.
Yeah. And from what I remember, they're going to have really good matches.
Yeah.
You know, which is another thing that people were going to really enjoy. It was like, oh, super kicks and all kinds of cool shit from Chris Adams.
Yeah. And then we have a great film. Sunshine, and then Precious gets involved in all this.
And Precious, and then by that way, you get in fucking Stella Mae French and...
Okay, well, let's not go bonkers on stuff.
No, but I mean, what they say is they run a lot of story out of this.
Yeah.
That doesn't involve the Von Erichs.
I wonder who pitched that idea of bringing Precious in to replace Sunshine and then Sunshine baby facing it. I don't know if this is something Mantell would pitch on his own. It feels like something maybe Jimmy Garvin might have pitched.
Well, he's like, hey, can I make out with my wife instead of my cousin?
Yeah,
that was the pitch right there.
And stuff. But okay, I just find it fascinating because, it's a Von Erich heavy promotion. It took the Freebirds linchpin to really get this thing cooking. But, you know, Adams and Garvin underneath are eventually going to start stealing some of the shows and getting a lot of traction also that made it more than just a one trick pony. I mean, you had Buddy and Ice, and that got over. But again, it was a Freebird involved. It's just fascinating that now we were getting something different where it opens up the door for World Class to bring in other talent to get over. But also, it also begs the question with Fritz, like, does he get territorial because this is his brother, his boy's territory, and he really gets a little, maybe gets a little threatened with how over Adams gets.
I don't think Fritz cared that much about that. Fritz cared about making money. And he has a hot baby face in Chris Adams, and he knew that eventually that's a hot baby face that he can turn the feud with the Kevin, which is exactly what happened.
But he would never, ever push him above his sons is what I'm getting at.
No. No one's getting pushed above the boys.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. But Adams gets a hell of a push because right around this time, you know, before the turn, he's got a great match with Flair.
Oh, he does. That's coming up.
That's coming up. That is based on the whole Flair. It's like, who's this jabroni?
Yeah.
And Adams takes it to him, and it's a great match. So he's with Sunshine at that point,
and she gets hit on by Flair.
That's right. So I think Fritz had a lot of faith in Chris Adams. He had to know. You know, I mean, he loved his boys and pushed the boys to the top. But especially if we're going to be losing David sooner than later, you got to have baby faces. You got to have strong baby faces, and Chris Adams was one.
And Adams was a kid, and when I was growing up, he was like my favorite wrestler as a kid because he was just so different than the rest of the because I grew up on this, and he was totally different than the rest of the brothers. He was more sophisticated. I mean, he was doing topes. He had that awesome super kick, and he was just a great baby face. But, hey, let's move on to Jimmy Garvin versus Iceman Parsons. Kelly, what do you think of this?
This was a decent little match. It's non-title. So we got Iceman in here, red hot. The crowd's just crazy. Mercer is just a total Garvin apologist.
I told you, he loves him now.
Yeah. He calls him a personable and pleasant man.
Yes.
That's just an odd description.
Probably because he gets to look Precious constantly.
Yeah.
It's confusing for the audience.
Here's what he says. He's personable, but he uses these cowardice type tactics.
Yes.
But he's not a coward. He's an enigma. I'm just call him a cheater. Say, yeah, he's a nice guy, but he cheats in the ring. He does these verbal gymnastics to try to get to that point. It's insane.
Yeah, it's weird that he's suddenly, you know, this is his new thing. And it's not like it's playing up like a babyface turn for Garvin or anything.
Not at all.
It's just him going out and doing his own thing, which is weird. Hey, that's Bill Mercer for you. A good back and forth match, and Iceman wins after reversing a suplex into a cradle, and the pop is huge. And here you go. Now you can do title matches, draw some money with these guys. So yeah, Garvin's got it going with pretty much all the baby faces in the territory right now.
And it also does something else here, and it's really subtle. Is they talk about it? It's because I know what happens in the future. Is they talk about a little bit on commentary where they're saying Jimmy Garvin's the number one contender to the world title, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Iceman gets a non-title victory. Harley's coming into town pretty soon, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep,
and Iceman gets the match.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because it's based off of, and so it makes sense. It's based off, you might be this, but Iceman beat you. So he's going to go and give the title shot to Iceman Parsons. So I find that pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the match was fine for what it was. But my favorite thing was Jimmy Garvin. Looks good, feels good too. That was a fantastic line by the guy. Johnny, what an insight you have on this thing.
Well, I love Iceman's ring gear, his sweatsuit and his... His trunks and his boots and his headband are all just powder blue and white. Everything matches, you know, and he looks badass. It looks cool. And there's a little bit of Garvin calls him boy. I could hate that shit. So while I'm yelling at the TV about Bill Mercer, I stopped myself and looked at myself and said, I'm yelling at a TV show from 36 years ago. What the fuck is wrong with me? But speaking of Sunshine and Bill Mercer, Bill gets this line out. As Sunshine's sitting at ringside, he goes, "Sunshine, looking perturbed and worried, the look on her face of despair right now, and loneliness." So what the fuck are you talking about? She's not lonely. And
he's convincing himself if he can ask her out.
Exactly. "You look lonely, my dear. You know, you need some company from old Bill. I just shaved." He says this about Iceman. I guess Garvin's on his back. And he goes, "The king is trying to find a way to get this court jester off his back." Oh, boy. But yeah, but Iceman won. I love that, too, because it plays into the story of last week. He's like, "I'm going to defend the title every week." And then, you know what happened. He changes his mind after he almost loses it to Chris Adams. And the very next week, he goes, "Oh, it's non-title this week," and he loses.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's good. So Iceman has a claim now. He has a claim, too. Being like, if you were putting up that title like you said you were going to, I could have been the champion. So it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question I want to ask you. I'll ask you first, Johnny, about Iceman. He's a guy who has a lot of charisma, has a really unique look. I guess he's a little on the short side. Do you think he might have been able to replace JYD in Mid-South?
No.
I don't think anyone could, but do you think you could do a better job of some of these other guys, like Master G?
Well, there's some of them, but by the time he was there, he was a heel, I think, right?
He got there, during the Mantel booking of, 86,
I don't know. It's something like Jim Ross said, too, when Watts was just running around trying to find the new JYD, but just by trying to find the new black guy.
Right.
It wasn't that easy. It was JYD.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that he was African-American. He was amazingly charismatic, and he was a huge star no matter what his skin color was.
Yeah.
So, the Watts is like, "I just need another black guy" thing. I didn't think he understood why Junkyard Dog was so popular. Because Junkyard Dog wasn't just popular with African-Americans.
Yeah.
Junkyard Dog was popular with every single person in the territory who was a fan of the territory. You could bring in Brickhouse Brown and Savannah Jack all you want, but that's not Junkyard Dog. I think Parsons would have had a better chance because he's more charismatic than all those other guys and is a better wrestler than all those other guys. But it's just so hard because I don't think anyone could have replaced Junkyard Dog. He was a phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough word, but that's kind of almost stacking the deck against the guy there. Let me follow it up with this. Are you surprised he didn't get a bigger run somewhere else? Because it seems like World Class was his peak run.
I'm trying to think where else he was in. It was just UWF.
He was in Young before this. He was in Portland, and he did the Mid-Atlantic run before that.
Okay. I couldn't remember if he was in the Jive Tones, and then I remember
But it felt like he would have, because his charisma seems like he screamed to get over more. I think he stayed a lot in Texas. I mean, because he still lives here.
I mean, that's it. You find a territory without a lot of traveling where you're super over and you can make money and live there. You don't want to leave. Maybe.
Because he just strikes me as a guy who could have gone into a lot of territories and meant something to me. Yeah, as in I felt he was like the same thing with Chris Adams when you think about it. And he didn't do a whole lot of traveling either. Then again, maybe the World Class just had a bad reputation. Where do you fall on this, Kelly?
Well, I mean, as far as the JYD thing, that was like lightning in a bottle. I mean, trying to replace JYD is like trying to replace Bruno or Hogan or any of the biggest stars of all time, really. It just was hopeless. And I mean, they did pretty well without JYD, going in a different direction.
Oh yeah, they actually had better year the year after they replaced him.
Yeah, but eventually, Watts did try.
But it was also had more to do with the fact where they went more of a this is the circus coming to town. Look who we have, the clown. They did more of a variety act type of thing to replace it. But also had draws too.
But as far as the guys Watts tried to replace JYD with, Parsons was better than all of them, I would say. And, it could have been. Well, Butch Reed was good, too, of course.
Well, that's just it. I was thinking of Butch Reed, too, and Butch Reed is an awesome wrestler. But even Butch Reed didn't have a connection with the crowd, the Junkyard Dog.
Yeah. No. He needed to be a heel. He needed to be JYD's foil.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Iceman, yeah, he's better, but he probably would have been just another one of those guys remembered as a failed attempt to replace JYD, really.
Right.
He may have been the best worker of them all, or the most charismatic, or most popular. But and as far as other territories, yeah, I mean, you can say that about a lot of guys. Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? I don't know. I don't know enough about the Iceman's career later in the 80s. You know, like, I know where he was, but I don't know if he had opportunities or, you know. But like you said, he was comfortable in Texas, comfortable in the area, decided to live there the rest of his life. So that's often a choice wrestlers make. They like to homestead instead of picking up and starting over again somewhere else.
Yeah, it just always surprised me because certain guys you see, wow, he had a lot of charisma. I'm shocked he didn't go to Memphis, or I'm shocked he didn't get a run during the Horseman era of Crockett and stuff. But then again, you know what? Back in the 80s, you got to remember too. Usually there was one African American per promotion. Sometimes there might be a couple more, but they're, for the most part, they were kind of. They were used more as a gimmick in a way.
It's one of the sad parts was there could only be one black guy back in the day. It's ridiculous. But even I thought about Memphis and Iceman too, and I was like, oh, Iceman would have fit in great in Memphis. He would have had great matches even as a heel with Lawler. But then I was like thinking, he's not going to make a fucking dime. You know, he's going to stay in Texas.
I'm like, yeah, he ain't going to make a dime.
You know?
Yeah, no.
He's making good money with Fritz.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you think about it, it starts dying up in 83, 84, the territories, too. So by 88, when you think about it, there really wasn't a whole lot of places to work. Then we move over to Kerry Von Erich versus Mr. Ebony. Johnny, what's going on here?
Again, the blue pants just don't fucking work on Mr. Ebony. I'm sorry. The red pants looked so badass, and now he's stuck to get the blue ones. They just... his coolness factor goes down. He's announced as, or I think Mercer says, Mr. Ebony is from parts and destinations unknown.
Yes.
Destination.
What does that mean?
I have no idea. And then he calls the Mongol, who's out there, the Mongol, which, and then he says, the Mongol, he's an assassin. And he's running in to attack Kerry, and he goes, the Mongol is coming in to assassinate Kerry Von Erich.
It's funny because Mercer in 63 was covering the Kennedy assassination and on TV. So he should have known better, really.
And then he says, as Akbar's running away, he says, Akbar heads to the sands of safety.
He's just a great wordsmith, isn't he? He's just
poetic. The match was what it was. You know, it wasn't. It was okay.
Yeah, it was solid. I thought Mr. Ebony looked like the black Super Invader.
Yes, very much.
They do a nice one thing. They do nice here. I mean, but it means absolutely nothing to me because I didn't want to see the match. But I'm wondering why in hell is the Mongol outside this whole freaking time? And it's to set up a tag match for next week. So,
well, it's also I noticed with the stuff we're going to be talking about today, they're mixing stuff up a little bit. They're getting ready to take a little breather from the Freebirds Von Erichs. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. And what they're moving into, and it was referenced last show, is they're going to have the Von Erichs do some business with Devastation Incorporated now.
Yeah.
We're going to move into that a little bit. So that's why we're suddenly getting the fucking Mongol assassinating Kerry Von
Erich. Yeah, and that's like the revisionist history the history I always think about is when you think of World Class being super hot, you think of the Von Erichs and Freebirds, you think of Adams and Garvin, you think of Iceman and Roberts, and you think of this Devastation Incorporated with the Missing Link and Kamala. Right now, we have, the NWOB team.
It goes in reverse to the NWO. It starts off horrible.
Yeah, starts off terrible, yeah. And it started off pretty good with King Kong Bundy and Kamala. You're like, okay, now we haven't seen Kamala in a while. Bundy, we haven't seen him forever because he's gone.
Yeah, Bundy's
gone. And then they replace him, and we get – Mr. Ebony and the Mongol. And right now, these guys are absolutely just terrible as like as a heel by the faction of heels where you're going to get over are going to be moving into the main feud. Yeah. It's terrifying, and in my mind, and I grew up on this, it was all roses, and now we're kind of seeing like, man, Devastation Inc. kind of had a lot of warts on it at first, and eventually they spin out of it and they get better. I mean, they were never a great work rate team, but when they got the right gimmicks in, the gimmicks that were awesome, like Kamala and Missing Link. I mean, those guys are great gimmicks. And it's kind of like talking about how the Adrian Street thing, he was a great gimmick. And that makes them stand out. And right now, man, we're like, oh no. What do you think about this there, Kelly?
Well, my first note was dream match right here. Kerry and Mr. Ebony. Cause I don't think they've faced off before. Yeah,
it's new. At least it's new.
There's something about it seems like, yeah, they should have some sort of weird chemistry together. I don't know. It was a typical Kerry, kind of clunky match. Not the most polished, a little rough in parts, of course. I liked the test of strength, or at least how it started. It was like, oh, yeah. Back and forth, and then Ebony had to kick Kerry in the gut to get out, but that was about the peak of the match. Not much after that. And Kerry wins with a power slam, which is kind of has he been using that much? I don't know. Kerry has a multitude of ways to beat you, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think that's cool. I like a wrestler that has multiple finishers.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think it makes it interesting on when you're going down the stretch and building false finishers and stuff.
Yeah.
But I also thought of Kerry with the discus punch and the claw. The power slam, you know, well. They should just stick to with his bread and butter.
Yeah. Yeah, this was definitely just kind of like a jam session match where they were just flinging stuff out. Anyway, moving on now.
And then we can go over here, Johnny. We get a recap of the Freebirds versus Von Erich feud. I mean, when you think about it, we're 9 months into this feud now. And it's been hot. The crowd is still buying everything into everything. So they haven't make you want to get rid of it yet to this audience. But it's a good point. It's a good idea to, hey, maybe let's throw a recap at our audience because they've been feuding for 9 months. Maybe they need to remember what the hell they're feuding for or why it started. And let's set up start laying the crumb work down for the blow off that's going to start coming in November and December. What did you think, John?
That's exactly what they're doing here. Mercer, he goes, it's been a terrible feud. I'm like, wrong choice of words, but here's the thing. They were specifically bringing up the cage match, and he particularly brought up the cage door and the handcuffs. I don't know if the handcuffs do or not.
They do.
The cage, they do. Okay, all of this plays into the blow-off loser leaves town match with Fritz at the door. We're not spoilers, but that match is just a culmination of the first match, the Flair cage match. You know, it. So they're re-educating the audience about the importance of the cage door. So that way, when they see what happens in a couple months, they go, oh, yeah. So I thought that's smart.
Yes. What about you, Kelly? Any insights here?
No, because I fast forward the recap. That's what I do.
Jeez, that's like a Johnny ate my homework, dog ate my homework. Wow.
My time is precious these days, Pete. I can't waste it on feud recaps or reruns of Chris Adams and Jimmy Garvin matches, so I'm all about fast forwarding. But yeah, no, it's you gotta recap it. It's 9 months or whatever. You gotta keep refreshing it. You know, that's the best part because you're gonna have new viewers every week, and it's like a Marvel comic that would always recap the origin stories every few months because you had the new readers. Just yeah, it's always smart to keep everybody up to speed on things.
Well, I would have fast forwarded too, but the teaser for this segment was says coming up next, the true story behind the Freebirds Von Erichs feud. I'm like, ooh, what's the true story?
Interesting.
And this rolls into Terry Bam Bam Gordy versus Bruiser Brody. And on paper, I was so excited for this. It was just a teaser, but I'll let you start off, Kelly, and then I'll throw some insights in here, and then we'll go to John.
Okay. Yeah. Big Hoss fight on paper. They started to fight before the introductions were even made, brawling outside. And then we get Mercer with the story of Gordy going to Japan and learning dangerous tactics from a mysterious professor, Sing Fu.
Sing Fu.
Yeah. Who also taught Professor Toru Tanaka, I believe.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess he had a run in Texas in the 70s or early 80s.
He worked Houston a lot. Yeah, he was in Texas. He was.
Anyway, so this is, Gordy's now back. He's got the Oriental Spike in his arsenal. We talked about this on previous episodes. And, yeah, anyway, so we have a wild match here. But short, of course. They're not going to give you too much on TV. Brody gets the pin off a cross body. And then the post-match angle, though, is all that really matters. Because that's where the Oriental Spike comes out. Brody gets busted open somehow. I think maybe just one of his old cuts opened up accidentally. That's kind of what it looked like. Anyway, it was great. Great little angle at the end to start a potential feud between these guys. And they're really getting the Oriental Spike over because it injured David, too. David's on the shelf because of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a cool new wrinkle for Gordy. This was fun.
Yeah, it gives him more of an element of danger, and I like that. I don't know if I would have pinned Brody here, but I will say no one remembered Brody getting pinned because of the angle, and because Brody didn't do a whole hell of a lot of layout angles or he got bloodied up and had to be helped out of the ring type stuff. So I think part of me is like, well, if you want to build to a feud with these guys, I would have gone with a non-finish, but I think there maybe the thought process was, or maybe might have been Brody, like, yeah, I'll lay out for the kid, but I'm getting the pin here. And again, this is all pure speculation, but I don't think they needed to pin Gordy here off Jump Street for this feud when the whole point was to get over the Oriental Spike. But hopefully they're thinking, well, no one will remember Gordy getting pinned. They're just going to remember the aftermath of Brody being laid out with the spike. I thought that was a nice piece of business. They gave you enough in the match where you want to see it, because these are the two biggest, baddest apples in Texas. So you definitely want to see that match, and then the post match. But yeah, I think I could have gone away with not seeing the pin, but I understand the rationale behind it. Where do you fall on this, John?
Well, so Gordy went to the Orient to study under Professor Sing Fu, like Kelly said. Sing Fu. I was like, what did he teach him? Gordy-san, wrap thumb with lots of tape, stick in throat. Lesson learned, Professor. And he's using the spike without the tape here. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. We've already been introduced to the Oriental Spike. Previous shows. Bill Mercer's called it the Oriental Spike on previous shows. Apparently, he's got amnesia because he doesn't know what the fuck it is. He's like, when he's using it, he goes, I wonder if that's the Oriental Spike that might have been given to him by the Professor Sing Fu. I'm like, what do you mean? We already know this. It is. It's been established. This is the move's already been established. And he keeps going on like it's a mystery. And he's like, I'm going to interview Brody after this. I come back and he's like, well, when I asked Bruiser Brody, he just walked away from me, you know, and didn't respond when I asked him a question. And that question was, Bruiser Brody, was that the Oriental Spike? And he just walked by me. I'm like, and he's like, was it the spike? And I'm like, yes, it's the fucking spike. We already know it's the Spike. Why are you questioning whether or not it's the fucking Spike? And then they go right to Buddy Roberts being interviewed. And the first thing he says, he's like, that's the Oriental Spike from Terry Bam Bam Gordy. Like, okay, you got your answer, Bill? Oh, it was so frustrating. It was annoying the shit out of me.
What do you think of the interview then?
Oh, I look, well, Terry Gordy just can't grow a mustache, can he? It's just, no. Nope. That poor guy, he's one of those guys.
I think he's a natural blonde, so that hurts.
He can't grow a mustache. He tries, but he's like, I go out there and I learn stuff for my job because this is my job, and I don't mind doing what I got to do. And when he says I, he points at his eye. I don't mind doing what I got to do. Don't know why he did it. Don't care. I loved it. I love Terry Gordy yelling nonsense.
Well, I got more out of this interview than you did. I thought it was really cool how they put the Spike over in their interview. Mm-hmm. And they're really getting it over as a real killer move here. And we see even more of that next week on the TV. What about you, Kelly? Where do you fall here?
Yeah, great. Like, yeah, the same note that the Buddy and Gordy put the Spike over. Great. Yeah, it's. I think, you know, they kind of retconned the start of the Spike now that they decided, oh, we're going to make it a bit more dangerous, introduce mm-hmm. Professor Sing Fu. And then Mercer, you know, knowing him, he probably just forgot that he'd actually commentated that before.
Yeah, he actually did forget.
I think that's the simplest answer.
Yeah, he actually did forget. Is that the Oriental Spike? Yes! And Fritz is yelling at him, God damn it, yes, last week!
Yeah, Mercer's just out of it, totally. But no, the Spike's over for sure.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't call this a great show by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
But I thought it was a solid show where I thought I did a lot of building blocks where we, you know, they reiterate. The reason they showed Garvin Adams again is like, hey, this is the start of the feud. Watch it, dummies, if you missed it last week. We follow that up with the Garvin Parsons thing, and we're showing the non-title thing and lays the groundwork for Parsons and Race in future match. They tease us, you know, they kind of set up the Von Erichs versus Devastation match for next week. They remind us, hey, look, this is why the Von Erich and Freebird feud started, and this is where it's headed, and you put some more, you know, reminders, and hey, we have a Gordy-Brody feud. Look at this, and then the Oriental Spike. I mean, I thought they did a lot of building blocks here. It wasn't one of those shows that stand out with match of the year or great match or anything like that, but I thought booking-wise, I thought this was a brilliant show. I don't use the word brilliant, but I thought the booking on this was a lot of building blocks to set up stuff for the future. So if you look at it that way, I thought the show was excellent, as in it's going to build stuff for the future or even just for just next week. Where did you fall on this one, Kelly?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, I mean, it was when it was over, I'd pretty much forgotten the whole thing, but you're right, they did build angles. They built up Iceman as a challenger. Candyman, I mean, ever since he's taken the book, you know, things have been pretty damn good. He's very good with logic and long-term booking. So, yeah. Let's see what's happening for this last bit of 1993, or 83, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mantell gets a rap because everyone, Gary Hart always, like, kind of steals the credit. And of course, that's another kind of revisionist history in a way. But, man, Mantell here in 83 and 84, I thought he did very good with the book. And I, especially with these blow-offs, like I talked about it a couple of shows ago. And you just brought it up earlier, Johnny, about the cage match and the hair match. Some of these blow-offs are just freaking some great, great storytelling that really enhanced stuff. What do you think about the show, John?
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, you did everything you guys said, but like Kelly said, it was utterly forgettable, you know, which is okay. You know, it's like even nowadays with anything modern, you know, it's like you don't have to watch every single fucking show. You know, if you watch, you know, expecting every Saturday morning TV show from a wrestling promotion in the 80s to every single one to be awesome is insane.
It might be forgettable, but I think in a few episodes, some of this stuff is going to pay off. Then it'd be like, okay,
That's what I mean. Just the storytelling aspect stuff, they got across what they had to do, but from everything
else.
Everything else is, yeah.
And that's the thing, wrestling's a story. It is not always about the matches. And
right.
And you just sometimes it's these episodes aren't all about not about work rate. It's about storytelling and drawing money. I think that's what they're trying to do here. And this is the match we were talking about. We were talking September 5th, 1983. And this is the main event of the show we've reviewed earlier a couple weeks back. This is the Freebirds versus Von Erichs. What do you think, Kelly?
It was.
And this is a very historical match because this is, I think, one of the only matches where we have all four brothers in the ring together.
Right. Yeah, well, right from the start, you get the Birds coming out to Georgia again, which it seems like they were using that song more than Freebird at this time.
I think that stemmed from Kevin's promo of Decency and Filth and
Georgia
and all
versus
this
Texas.
Georgia Texas feud, yeah.
Yeah, and plus Freebird is more of a babyface theme.
Yeah.
Even though they used it in Georgia, of course, in the early 80s, but still, it works totally in the context of the feud with Von Erich. And, of course, LaGrange is blaring for the boys. What an entrance with Michael, yes. Like Von Erich in tow. The announcer, Ranelli, is it? I always
forget. Yeah, Ranelli. Oh,
right, he's horrible. And he gives like this real
fabulous Von Erich brothers.
Right.
So the Von Erichs are fabulous, and the Freebirds are not, according to him. But he gives this real long-winded intro for Mike Von Erich about he's going to be ready by the end of the year. He's going to finally
best amateur of the brothers.
He's
the number one amateur. He was getting put over. Day one, Jump Street. It was nausea here, honestly, what's coming up.
Well, since you brought it in, here's exactly what he said. He's like, the fabulous Von Erich brothers, Kevin, David, and Kerry, and another one of the fabulous Von Erichs, who'll be when Papa Von Erich says so. Far, he's the best of the amateurs, Michael Von Erich. So, I mean, it didn't even make any sense.
No. Yeah.
While he was Papa Von Erich, he's the best. I was like, what the fuck is going on here? Between that and the goddamn Confederate color guard in there, I was like, what the fuck is this nightmare?
Big match, of course. The crowd's just, particularly women, just screeching the whole way through. The boys dominate early. Until Kerry gets a little too cocky, a little too flashy, and misses an elbow off the top rope. I thought that was kind of funny how that leads to the Birds getting some heat on Kerry. Kerry just being a bit too much of a show-off there. But that doesn't last long. I thought it was going to be a proper heat saving on Kerry, but no. He tags into Kevin, so Kevin has to get his big shine too. And then it's kind of rinse-repeat as all three gang up on Kevin, and then, you know, things break down. You know, I thought this was a pretty good match until the finish. Things broke down, all six men in the ring. The referees totally lost control. In the middle of this, Kerry hits Gordy with a massive punch. Gordy sells awesomely. Huge bump over the top rope. Then we get the dreaded Oriental Spike on Kerry. Total chaos. I thought, you know, the way it was going, like the ref, this should have been a match that the ref throughout based on what we've seen in the past. You know, one of my big pet peeves in wrestling is matches that make referees look stupid, and this made him look dumb, that he just lets it all go, and then suddenly in the middle of it all, Hayes gets a sneaky pin on Kerry that he counts. I don't even know if they were the legal men in the ring or, you know. Anyway, like I said, a pet peeve of mine. The ref looks dumb. So the Birds retain the six man trophy with the end here. And I went 3 1/4. The my feelings about the finish dragged it down a bit for me. But I mean, the crowd was nuclear hot the whole way through. The work was good. But yeah, this wasn't a, I wouldn't call this a classic Freebirds versus Von Erichs match.
No, no, but it was really good. I gave it 3 3/4, and man, if you're going to be about refs being dumb, you have a lot of wrestling you must hate, or stuff that bothers you, because in the 80s, there's a lot of spots that make the refs look dumb.
Kelly's got a point here, because Calhoun here, the ref, he looks particularly stupid. And it's like he's standing there waving his arms, like going, "What's going on? What's going on?" And then the finish is Gordy's got the spike, and he and Carey passes out, and he's just laying there passed out, and Calhoun's running around looking at everything but not doing anything.
I see. Part of me liked the finish because it involved the spike and they're getting that thing over. But the other part of me was like, what the hell's going on? Why is anyone pinning Carey at this point?
Yeah, Carey just lays there for a little while before Hayes goes over and pins him. It was a little anticlimactic.
Yeah, I think the timing was off on that.
I blame Calhoun. I totally blame Calhoun for everything. He's terrible.
Yeah. But I enjoyed this. I liked it because there's a lot of fists and feet here. A lot of back and forth early, and then you see the birds work over Carey. That triple drop kick always gets just a great pop from the crowd. The Von Erichs and the start to isolate Buddy, and he still has the headgear, and Kevin's working over Buddy, and then Buddy gives Kevin a nasty headbutt with it, and this might have been the best sell job I've ever seen Kevin ever, and Kevin is selling almost death here, just flailing away from the headbutt shot, and I thought it was awesome, and we saw, and that's what puts Kevin on face in peril, so I absolutely love the setup to putting Kevin in, actually selling, and Kevin really sold here. It was really honestly one of the better Kevin sells spot. And
maybe Buddy actually put a piece of steel in there and goes, "I'll get this motherfucker to sell."
I can understand the confusion on the finish, but I did love the fact that they're still trying to get the spike over. What did you think, John?
The only other thing I have to add, the match is fine. I thought it was chaos, and I like chaos, but then again, I'm exactly like with Kelly. I'm like, at the end, everything looked discombobulated. It looked like Calhoun didn't know what the fuck he was doing. But yeah, super hot, just screaming, great. But then the only other thing I have to add is fucking Minnelli, so bad. Here's how he announces the winner. He goes, "Well, you saw how it happened. The Freebirds are still the six-man champs." You saw how it happened? God damn, he's awful.
Totally awful.
Terrible.
Johnny, anything you want to plug?
Nah, nothing off the top of my head.
Kelly?
Well, I do want to plug our loyal listeners, you know, and all their generosity.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Donating to the cause, able to pay off the SoundCloud fees for another year. And especially want to thank Sean Emily, our biggest fan, obviously. We've mentioned him on the show before.
Puts his money where his mouth is, motherfuckers.
Yeah, he was very generous. Basically contributed, you know, like 50% or more towards the goal. So that's great. And so I thought, well, as a reward, we should let him choose a show for us to review. You know, that's how people with those big time Patreon podcasts do things, right? So yep. I let him choose, and he let us know what he wants us to watch, and we're going to be reviewing that in 2 weeks. But we're going to keep it a surprise.
Oh, we're keeping it a surprise.
Yeah, okay. Let's keep it a surprise. I'll just say it's going to be something very unusual for us to review. That's for sure. But it should be pretty fun, too.
Well, on that note, follow me at Titans O Wrestling on Twitter. Have a great week. Have a great Labor Day. Watch this is dropping after Labor Day. I hope you all had a great Labor Day. Keep it fun and real. Laters.
My heartaches and troubles are just up and gone. The moment that you come in view, and with your hand in mine, dear, I could dance on and on. across Texas with you in my arms. Waltz across Texas with you. Like a storybook ending, I'm lost in your charms, and I could waltz across Texas with you.